As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Standing Room Only podcast. Yes, I'm your host, Ben Standing. I cover the Washington Commanders for The Athletic. It's Wednesday, late morning, early afternoon here in the DMV. Hope everyone is doing well, and I'm sure you guys are all paying attention to this week with the Commanders, seeing as how they have not one, not two, not three, but four of these quarterback prospects in town right now. As I'm talking at the facility, they were all here yesterday for some top golf action, along with a lot of other prospects, and needless to say, we're getting down to the end here with what Washington may ultimately do with the NFL draft on April 25th. We will talk about some of these prospects with another great guest who knows these knows the draft well. Greg Cosell with NFL Films joined me recently to discuss these quarterbacks, but we also got into a lot of the other positions as well, because this draft isn't just about that number two pick, even though it's the one we all talk about the most. But also, to that end, the way teams attack the draft, why does it seem like some teams just really, really struggle with it? Why do some teams seem to understand how to roster build better than others? My colleague, Alec Lewis, who we just had on here fairly recently, he covers the Minnesota Vikings. He wrote an interesting story this week about just this topic. Why are some teams just really bad at the draft? And what, even when they know that there are viable options out there in terms of strategies that work, what is the struggle? Why do teams have an aversion to actually using some of these methods? We talked about that. We also talked about Jaden Daniels because of a story Alec wrote last season about how using virtual reality really helped Jaden Daniels this season. So a lot to get to. We're going to get to all that and a little bit more here on the Standing Room Only podcast. You can, of course, find us iTunes or wherever you do your podcasting. As far as The Athletic goes this week, I had a couple of different stories up. I had one where I did mock drafts six different ways to try to show here. Okay, you know, I always think it's a butterfly effect. If you do this, okay, that may be good, but then you're potentially missing out on that. Or if they start a draft, you know, quarterback, offensive tackle, then what does that look like if you want a cornerback and a receiver later and vice versa? So did that. And then today I have a story up about the offensive tackle prospects headlined in this story by Patrick Paul, the brother of Chris Paul. I had a chance to talk to both of them over the course of this pre-draft cycle. So you can check that out for, you know, what I would say is the next biggest need after the quarterback. How does Washington go about that? And who are some of the possible targets for them? So there's that. Now, a couple of things also about this week. Number one, I'm going to have the next podcast up this week will be a mock draft. I've done this every year for the last few years with myself and Evan Silva from Establish the Run, where we typically go back and forth with these picks. You know, I've had success in the mock draft contest. Evan has also been a winner there. But this time we're making it a three-man game. My guy Danny Heifetz from The Ringer, who's part of their NFL draft coverage, will also be joining us. So it'll be a three-person mock draft. I'll play that for you later this week. And one more here, one more note. On Thursday at noon on The Athletic for subscribers, I will be doing a live chat to talk about whatever you want with regards to the Commanders, or really whatever you want. You want to talk about the Wizards, the NBA playoffs, what TV shows I'm watching, whatever you got, I'm happy to discuss. So we'll do that on Thursday at noon on The Athletic. My guy Mike Smelt, who's been on here several times, will help as a moderator, talker as well. So busy week. What is what you'd expect, of course, because the NFL draft is right around the corner. All right, a couple of notes here before I get into these interviews. The Commanders have been busy this week in terms of adding people to the organization. Most notably, they've hired, and I'm going to pull up the press release here to make sure I have it all right with all the names and the titles and all that fun stuff. They've hired Dave Gardy as the team's senior vice president of football initiatives. Now, sure, what does that mean? A name most have never heard of and a position title that seems fairly generic. Mike has been with the NFL league office for 21 years. He's held the role of the senior vice president of football ops for 10 years, and he has done a lot of the work over the year with regards to a lot of the legal issues, with regards to the rule book, a lot of that interesting stuff. And it says here that Gardy will handle a number of in-game management duties and will support the coaching staff and front office on compliance with league protocols, officiating trends, and health and safety guidelines. Now, everything I just said to you, it's okay. Sounds great. I mean, you know, sure. It's another sign of Josh Harris investing in this organization beyond just sort of the obvious things, right? Here's an example, though, of the way the people who, both reporters and others around the league, who are talking to league people in the league office all the time. There has been a lot of mention about this hire and how a lot of people are surprised in a very good way for the Commanders that they were able to pry this guy away. I received a text from a high-ranking NFL executive the other day, just out of the blue. I'm going to read you the text. It says, "In Dave Gardy, the Commanders hired one of the great people in this business. There was nobody at the league office who was more trusted or valued by clubs. Universally admired and respected. Phenomenal move." People don't generally praise too much what others are doing. You know, maybe if it's like somebody, you know, they hired that team's assistant GM or a coach or something like that. But this isn't that. This is somebody, you know, in hired from a league office. It is quite wild that the reaction that's been out there. So what does this actually mean? We'll find out more when we talk to presumably Adam Peters. We're going to talk to you this week. I should say that as well. Adam Peters is scheduled to talk to us on Thursday, so I'll have a reaction to that as well. But it is a notable hire, and I think more to the point, you know, Josh, it's one thing, again, this, I talk about this a lot when, say, I talk about the Wizards or maybe before with Dan Snyder. It's not enough to just pay players. You've got to, do you make the infrastructure around them as good as it can be? You can talk to me about first class, everything, all you want, but show it to me. And the Commanders are showing that. Again, what Gardy does ultimately, we'll see. But I think so far, this is another example of Josh Harris doing more than just saying, we need a coach, we need a GM, we need a quarterback. What else can we do? They've already bulked up the analytics department. This is another example. They did also make another hire this week, which was, it's not a new position, but just another hire to work towards the goal of the stadium. We can talk more about that down the line, what that means for sure. But they also have added a person for that, somebody who comes from government, somebody who's with worked in a senator's office. So it sounds like it's somebody who understands how to deal with Capitol Hill. Needless to say, if the RFK site is still in play, then that could be a potentially good person to have on board. All right, let's, beyond that, you know, look, obviously we're focused on the draft. I can't say that anything has really changed. If you've been paying attention to other people beyond myself, you know, the Jaden Daniels part of this is still feels like there's more momentum there. Dane Brugler, our NFL draft insider, he put up a 7-round mock draft today as others have said, as I've said repeatedly, his comment about with Washington was that it is not easy to get information out from there right now. I'll just leave it at that. But go check out Dane's mock, and I will just say he has Patrick Paul going to the Commanders in the second round. I wrote about Patrick Paul, as I said, so good synergy there for us. All right, now let's do this. I'm gonna start with Alec. Greg is obviously a great guest, but I want to start with something that's not quarterback. And I think this was a really fun conversation with Alec regarding roster building, what he found in talking to people around the league. We talked a lot about the process in here because it ties in to a story I wrote last year. It's my pin tweet about how the process could look in the NFL, and more specifically, you know, what are the types of things that owners have to decide on when it comes to going for it or blowing it all up. And, you know, I personally just think this is a really interesting topic for sure. So we'll get to that with Alex. We'll talk about Jaden Daniels, how he really improved last year with virtual reality, and then Greg Cosell on all these prospects. Let's do that right now here on the Standard Room Only podcast. All right. We are, you know, obviously getting inching closer to the draft. And while we're focusing so much on what Washington is going to do it to, which quarterback, all that good stuff, so much of this discuss comes down to what is the team's philosophy when it comes to the draft, and to some extent, why do some teams suck at doing this? And my colleague at The Athletic, Alec Lewis, who we had on this podcast a few weeks ago talking about possibly would the Vikings trade up, he covers the Vikings, if I didn't just say that, wrote a great story this week on The Athletic about that exactly. Like, there's known methods that can work, and yet teams tend to ignore them. Why is that? So Alec was kind enough to give me some more time here to talk about that and some other topics, including Jaden Daniels and his growth this year. First of all, thanks for doing this. How are things? Are you? I know I'm going nuts over all this quarterback talk. How are you surviving? Because for you, it's trade talk, I assume.
Yeah, it's relentless. First, thanks for having me, Ben. Nice to catch up again. I missed the weather in Orlando. It's kind of cold here in Minnesota, but I don't know if the listeners know, but it tends to get pretty cold in Minnesota. But no, happy to be here. Really ready for the draft. It could get here any moment. I'd really appreciate that. It would be good for my mental health, probably good for my physical health. Have listened to trade idea scenario conversation for a long time. Still very uncertain what the Vikings will ultimately do. I think it depends on two specific things. How much are they ultimately going to be willing to give up to move up? And then how competitive is that market going to be to move up? And those two factors to me will decide what the Vikings ultimately do, but I expect them to draft a quarterback somewhere. And until then, we'll talk about it, but thanks for having me. Should be fun to talk.
So what's interesting is, of course, you know, what is the right path for any team when it comes to roster building? And certainly every scenario can be different depending on whether you have a Patrick Mahomes on the roster, where you're starting at the bottom, you're stuck in the middle and can't get out. There's lots of specific scenarios, but at the same time, there are some ways, and you know, that make a lot of sense. And we've talked about that here in a bit, in part because of the owner here, Josh Harris, yeah, and what he did with the 76ers and the process. And I wrote a story about this last year, but you went more specific on the idea of, do teams actually know what they're doing, and when they go rogue, why are they doing that? So just give us, I guess, sort of the baseline for what was your, you know, what were you trying to learn about when you started this, and, you know, what did you kind of figure out?
Well, I guess I'll start, like, I covered Major League Baseball for 3 years, and then I transitioned over to the NFL covering the Vikings at The Athletic. And last year was really my first year going through it. And I went through the entire draft process. You read all these mock drafts, you read all this analysis, you read quotes from team people explaining how they have more information than people publicly. And ultimately, I guess in my head, I was just like, do people really know? And like, if they didn't know who was going to be better than another, like, why do the misses exist so frequently? And I guess part of me just thought a lot about the Vikings situation, because in 2022, the first year general manager, Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, traded down from number 12 to number 32. And the pick they traded down, they ended up being Lewis Seen, who has been terrible. He has not played really at all defensively. And people publicly in the market just crush him for his inability to evaluate talent. And so part of me is like, is he really bad at evaluating talent? Is it just a random one-off? Can you be better at evaluating talent than others? So all these questions are like swirling through my mind. And I guess it hit January this year, and I told my editor, I want to dive into the randomness of the draft. And he was like, you sound like an idiot, kind of, just because it's a dumb idea. And it was the most general and broad, but I was just passionate about it. So he was like, you know what, if you're interested in it, go for it. And it ultimately led me down a pretty fun path where I'm reading research produced by behavioral economics, behavioral economists about markets and about uncertainty. And ultimately, I mean, I think I come to find out like the best approach in the draft is probably give yourself as many dart throws as possible, and ultimately some will land. Now, you said it accurately. You're trying to do that within the confines of a 53-man roster where you need stars and you need a quarterback. So it's a very complex algorithm and process that is I think why it's been studied by behavioral economists, because it's such a fun pool of decision making and uncertainty, and I find that as fascinating as they do, I think.
Yeah, no, I am so fascinated by this topic as well. I've always said that, you know, I know a lot of people who do what we do view the NFL through the lens of a wannabe coach to a degree. They love diving into the X's and O's and try to figure out what's going on there. And I'm not that guy. I definitely always view these things more from the role of the general manager. How you put together a roster, you know, where do you trade up? Where do you trade back? What are the things to do to make a roster work? And I tend to find that the sort of kind of where your story, I think, kind of laid out that, like you said, the dart throws is ultimately what matters. And just to tangent off here to the 76ers with under Josh Harris, you know, they go through the process. It's fascinating to me. I'm curious what you think, how people view what happened there. The ultimate idea was people point to the tanking, right? They were obviously horrendously bad for several years. That sport, you need, you know, one guy can make all the difference.
No question. Right?
We see that all the time. The Sixers have not made it to a conference final. They have not made it to an NBA final, obviously. But they won 50 games basically every single year since they started to try, with Joel Embiid being one of the guys they got and succeeding. You know, he's one of the, you know, whatever you want to say, five best players in the league when he's healthy and all that. They were so bad at the rest of it. So many of the decisions they made subsequently, in part because they changed, I think, the GM, but they made bad trades, injury, Ben Simmons, whatever it was, a lot of things didn't work. And yet, and so people think the process failed. I think it's a complete opposite. It has succeeded, and it has shown that by doing it this way and having all these dart throws, just even making one hit can offset all the mistakes you make as being, as you're saying, with the Vikings GM, maybe struggling with the talent evaluation part of it because you have more darts at it. And I think that's the thing that people don't get, and I find incredibly fascinating.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I did a lot of work on the story looking at the NBA. It's such a different, like you just said, it takes sometimes is one superstar to transform your team. But it's funny to me that when we talk about this idea of trading down and accumulating picks, the two places your mind always goes, not you specifically, but the fans' minds typically and media always go are the process with the 76ers and the process, as people call it, with the Cleveland Browns. But people never talk about Sam Presti for some reason to me. And maybe it's because he's had success and seen it all the way through. But I did a lot of work going back to the archives of the Seattle newspapers and Washington newspapers when he first took over as the GM of the Supersonics. And he explained at the time, you can't shortcut team building. You can't shortcut it. And he traded Ray Allen and Rashard Lewis left the Sonics team, and they essentially did an entire full rebuild. They ended up with Kevin Durant, with Russell Westbrook, and had an incredible amount of success. Now, they didn't win an NBA championship, so I guess you could argue the degree of which of their success. And then recently, they stripped it down again, and Sam Presti wrote an op-ed in the Oklahoma newspaper about 2-3 years ago talking about, like, this is not going to be an easy process. Yeah, I don't know if he said the word process, but right. this is going to be a long-term view to team building. And ownership trusted him enough to see it through. And now look, what they're number one in the West. They have a billion draft picks over the next 5 years. So for some reason, I always find it so interesting that his name never gets brought up, maybe because of the way he talks to the media, maybe because of, I don't know what it is, but you.
To that point, I would just say he's definitely a lower profile guy. Like, I've heard from people that have covered that team that, like, they're not very media friendly. They just do. The Sixers promoted the process. Like, it was, sure. It was a story. I think it was Sports Illustrated with Pablo Torre. Like, they were like, no. A lot of teams do this to a degree, but they just they pretend like this is what the Wizards owner has done. They pretend they're trying,
right?
So fans don't get turned off. They were like, no. We are aggressively going to be bad. We want you to understand this. We want you to know this, and thus they became infamous for it. Whereas, like, Presti, other than this op-ed, probably just doesn't say too much.
Yeah, no, and I think the media aspect of it to me is fascinating. But I guess I say all of that and bring him up to say ownership for the Oklahoma City Thunder. I think the owner is Clay Bennett. I don't even really know who that is, but for some reason, maybe it's Presti's success. I don't know what it is. He has been willing to convince that owner that taking this long-term view over time and not acting irrationally is an optimal approach. And I think in the NFL, where you have, as Luke Bourne, who has studied a lot of this, said to me for the story, you have such high dollar decisions and you have such an emotional playground. And those two things create such bizarre behavior to where an approach like the Ravens have taken, which is to amass a lot of picks in the draft, just seems kind of boring. It's not as flashy, but you look time and time again at their success and it's hard to argue with it. And that, to me, those dynamics, I mean, someone said to me in the story, like, and it's relevant probably to Washington, like, maybe the biggest competitive advantage of professional sports that nobody ever talks about is the owner and his willingness to go through tough times, even if it's the right approach and strategy. And I thought that was such a fascinating comment. It's one that will probably shape how I view things for a long time.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, people here know why I talk about the Wizards sometimes, the team I used to cover and, you know, grew up rooting for. And their owner, up until very recently, it's only been in the last year that he finally said, fine, we're going to completely reboot this thing. And he brought in new people and they traded Bradley Beal and so on. But prior to that, he was unwilling to ever do it, even when it was obvious, like, they were stuck in the middle. They didn't have the requisite superstars you need. He just was so desperate to keep making the playoffs as, like, the 8th seed. I'll always say, for that playoff revenue or whatever, he was unwilling to bite that. He was unwilling to take the step back. But, you know, and I get it, right? You pay all this money for this stuff. You don't want your building half empty all the time. But to what end? And, you know, the Thunder. The other part of this is more of an NBA thing than an NFL team, but in the NBA, these teams like Presti and the Sixers, they, because they're keeping their payroll low by having lousy rosters, they are able to absorb lousy contracts from other teams who then attach picks to that. And like the Thunder, they're the one seed right now going into the playoffs with all these young players they've acquired and have an insane amount of future picks to continue to add. It feels like the NFL would be ripe for this. The one time that this I recall a team doing this was when, I think, the Browns, right? They acquired Brock Osweiler from the Broncos they took on his bad contract at that point, but got a second round pick out of it. And I remember when that happened, I was like, oh my Lord, is this happening? Is this really going to become where the league goes? And obviously it never did. I find it so fascinating. If I was a lousy team, I think I would try to do this more, or even not even a lousy team, but just any team to some degree when you have some cap room to try to do this.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very sensible, but I mean, then the problem gets into the aspect of the story that I found some of the most interesting is the problem is you have these GMs and head coaches whose time horizon and their life cycle in their jobs is very short, and they know that. And so the willingness to punt for the present for the future is really hard when your job might ultimately be on the line. And it's not really something they would ever talk about. And it's not something that we talk about, I think, a lot publicly, but like the human dynamics of wanting to keep your job, of trying to kind of quiet media public pressure. I mean, those facets are at play. I mean, there are differing incentives. The GM might want to build for the long term, take on a draft pick. The head coach might say, no, I need this player. I need another player with the cap room that we have to win right now. And so those competing incentives, to me, is just part of what makes it probably like such a messy process. I mean, someone else for this story said to me, and it, I guess it was a little tongue in cheek, but it's like, if a team just took some of these approaches for like a 5-year span, if they just tried it, then like, he's like, I think they would be set up in such an like incredible capacity. I mean, the Cleveland Browns, essentially, I think they went 1-31 over a 2-year span. And I talked to Kevin Mears, who was the director of research and strategy at the time. He's like, let me tell you, like, it sucks in the building when that's happening. Like, it is brutal. It's hard to operate. It's a terrible like feeling when you lose that much. But ultimately, that losing led to Myles Garrett. It led to David Njoku. It led to really key pieces. And obviously, they are a different situation in that their roster was so depleted when they kind of deployed that approach. But it's just such an interesting dynamic. And you get into, well, if the owner's older, then he probably wants to win now too. So why would they operate that way? So I think
the Atlanta Falcons, the Falcons is here for me, are that team. Arthur Blank made it pretty clear he wants to win. He wanted Belichick to some degree, and he was talked out of it. And I think he's like, all right, well, cool, but now we better win.
And Kirk Cousins as well. I mean, you don't sign Kirk Cousins that contract. It limits what you can do with the rest of the roster. And yes, I covered Kirk. I personally really like Kirk. I enjoyed watching him. I think he's really solid as a player. But with that contract, it limits how you can surround a roster. And so maybe it leads you to 10 wins in the playoffs or whatever, but it might not lead you to the Super Bowl. And that's what a lot of these teams cover. So the question is just in the topic to me, it's just so when you think about, like, it's so funny because fans and even media, we fixate on like, who are they going to draft in the third round, fourth round? It's like, if you don't have this macro strategy right and ownership vision right, then all these minor little things that we fixate on, I'm not sure how much they really matter.
100%. I think we all focus way too much on the minutia and the bigger stuff is sitting there. And to your point about the Browns, you know, the Browns and the Sixers are also, I think, similar in this regard. What happened with the Sixers was, so they set themselves up with all these picks, but then because it was such a PR nightmare, not so much in Philly, but around the league, that there was pressure put on, I think, kind of by the league to say, hey, you guys can't keep doing this. This is making us look stupid. So they got rid of Hinkie. They brought in sort of generic owner front office, who then said, oh, we have all these picks. This is fun. Let's do some stuff. Then they do some stuff, and it does not work out for the most part. And, you know, that becomes a problem. Whereas, like, the Browns, they have all these picks, and then they're like, oh, hey, wait, Deshaun Watson's available? Cool. So let's go do that. Forget even the off-the-field stuff with him. He had at that point hadn't played a lot, and it hasn't worked and for the most part. And yet, this last season, despite Deshaun Watson barely being a positive factor, they won 11 games in a division that also had two other playoff teams, right? So, like, And the Bengals were the non-playoff team, and they were basically 500. So it goes to show that they put together a good roster. Now, again, you know, coaching matters and all that, but it just goes to show that if you have more, pieces, you can overcome some stuff. And last thing I'll just say is, in the NFL, it almost makes even more sense than the NBA because third and fourth round picks are expected to contribute quickly and be start and can be. You know, you have 22 starters and special teams guys, so. It's not just one guy. It's you need an army, and this is one way to get there. And yet, teams don't really want to do it.
Right, like you're exactly right with that comment just there. Like the NBA, a second round pick. I mean, about a dart throw. Like it is. I mean, you're throwing the dart from 30 yards out. It's really, really tough. Whereas the NFL, I mean, Fred Warner, third round pick. I mean, Russell Wilson, third round pick. I'm obviously naming highlights, and there are a lot of busts in these rounds, but the odds of landing a really elite guy, I mean, they exist. And the issue is, and one of the most fascinating parts of it to me, Bill Polian said to me, he's like, I think Super Bowl teams, you have to have 12 A-level players. He said, I always believed this. And the interesting back and forth with that is, typically you find A-level players in the first round. You just do. But the argument is, do you know which players are going to be A-level and how confident can you really be? Whereas if you have two later round picks that may not lead to A-level players, they could, they may not. Are you more willing to have the multiple darts than the belief that a guy is A-level? And that back and forth to me is probably very preventative, I think, of this strategy often. But I again, like, as you can hear probably, like, I think all of this is just very interesting. And, like, I mean, it's interesting to me that Eric DaCosta essentially said out loud, like, I read this paper that was published in 2005. Ozzie Newsome always operated with wanting more picks. They've done it. And the Ravens have been pretty consistent, I would say, just over and over and over.
The Ravens are always one of the better teams. There's something about the vibe they have over there. It seems like ever since, like, the Ray Lewis era, they've maintained that. But having the many picks has certainly been a big factor for them, no doubt. So let's ask this then, to go back to your team specifically for this year. So the Vikings have already made one trade up, acquiring the 23rd pick. They do that. Now they have picks 11 and 23. And immediately the thought is, okay, this suggests that they now have the assets to move all the way up to into the top five if they want to get one of these quarterbacks. I think the other argument could be, at a minimum, they're in position to get Bo Nix or Michael Penix Jr. at the 23rd pick if they want to do that, or even go nuts and take one of them at 11, knowing they have another pick. I don't know if they've already crossed the threshold here of going against what it is that we're discussing, but they're now at this point of, okay, can they be aggressive? So as having just done this work, what do you kind of see with the Vikings in regards to where they're at now, going all in possibly for this quarterback, or, you know, staying put and just kind of building from what they have?
Well, it is interesting because, like, they made that trade to acquire 23 as I'm, like, reporting this story and thinking about it. And one of the facets of the story, I think it may have been a paragraph or a line. Someone said to me, like, if you make multiple draft trades and you also make a bunch of picks, then people can analyze and people can criticize both the moves, the trade moves and the pick moves. And so you saw early, like, they acquired number 23. And so there's already this public narrative. Is it a good trade? Why is it a good trade? Should Kwesi have done this? Should he not have? And I'm, like, thinking as I'm reporting the story, this is just, like, so related and so interesting to watch in real time. I mean, Kwesi Adofo-Mensah is a former Wall Street trader, very analytical mind, derives from the Cleveland Brown organizations, which is one of the most analytical in the NFL. And he said essentially last week in his press conference, like, I understand the uncertainty. I understand the irrationality of trading up. But when you're doing it for a quarterback, that ultimately it's worth taking on a little more risk. And I think that's what some of the most recent studies have found, that if you're trading up to acquire a quarterback, then you can make it make sense, because the value over a long period of time, it transcends what the pick value would ultimately be. Now, the question would be, do you operate like the Carolina Panthers did, trading a future first round pick? And ultimately, if you lose, then that pick becomes the number one pick. That's a tough decision. So really, to me, it'll be fascinating to see, both in real time and potentially learn afterward, were they willing to give up the future first? Because I think if you're talking giving up 11 and 23 to move up, not the biggest deal. It's not the biggest package ever. If you're talking multiple future first that could be high-end picks, I mean, that is a lot to give up for a guy who I'm almost certain in Kwesi Adofo-Mensah understands some of this methodology and some of these studies and research. So it's going to be interesting to see what maybe his line of demarcation is in terms of the value that he's ultimately willing to pay.
All right, let's switch subjects, but sort of staying on the quarterbacks. You've been on a roll here, writing some really good stuff. You wrote a story during the season that I remember reading in real time, but at that point, I think Washington was still, I wasn't projecting them being in position to get Jaden Daniels with the second pick. And you wrote about how Jaden Daniels, one of the reasons that he really developed this year, you know, he'd been a fine college player, but he threw almost as many touchdowns this year as he had in his previous four. And you wrote a story about how a virtual reality application or whatever, he was using virtual reality to help him improve. I'm curious, one, how did you learn about this? And two, what did you find out about this?
Yeah, it's I mean, people are going to be like, who is this guy? And why are these stories so out there? But this, for some reason, is stuff that fascinates me. So I did a story last year on Justin Jefferson. And essentially the question at the time, this was before the 2023 draft, the question was, how did Justin Jefferson, who's arguably the best receiver in the NFL, how was he passed up four or five times in the NFL draft? And what did teams miss in terms of his ability that maybe they could learn from? And I ended up for that story talking to a guy, Jack Marucci, who is also the founder of the Marucci Bat Company, Major League Baseball. He's a brilliant guy. He's been in the business for a long time as an athletic trainer, as a kind of director of research at LSU. And I, after that story, I stayed in touch with Jack just because he thinks interestingly about things, and I find him really fascinating. And I remember texting him, man, maybe in the fall or winter, like, pretty amazing to watch this Jaden Daniels guy. Like, I just watched, I think, him play Missouri, which is my alma mater. And I was like, this guy's unbelievable. And I texted Jack, and he's like, and he said in reply, like, you'd find it pretty interesting. He's actually using this technology based out of Germany to help him process information quicker. And I was like, that's crazy. And I would like to do a story on that. The problem was I was in the middle of Kirk Cousins tearing his Achilles, so I couldn't dive in immediately. But on my off week, ended up sitting down with Jack over Zoom, and then meeting the two staffers based in Germany who own the company called Cognilize, which is essentially this platform that they built in Germany that uses virtual reality, where the player can essentially take reps as if they are on the field, just as many reps as they can. And Jaden Daniels was willing to try this software out. They built it out with LSU over the course of the year. And essentially, I mean, the best way to describe it, and it's not doing it justice, is imagine being plugged into a video game and you're at quarterback and things are moving realistically across the field and you're in the pocket having to make decisions as quick as a quarterback would. And so it's just unlimited reps, essentially, using LSU's play calls that, Jaden swore by, and LSU said that he continued to come to them, be like, I want to do more of this. I really want to improve my processing ability. And so they felt it really helped. We don't talk enough about this either. Like, if you're a backup quarterback, you don't get to take a ton of reps. So improvement, especially in like a real simulated quarterback environment, is very rare. And maybe this is a product that catches on. I know other NFL teams have been in touch with Cognilize in Germany to try to kind of link up with them. But Jaden really took to it. He was really the first guy who has. And obviously, I think a lot of scouts would say they saw improvement in his processing ability over the course of the season.
Yeah, no, one of the things you hear about him is that the throwing mechanics are very repeatable for him. Like, it isn't like it's, you know, like with Drake May, there's more of this conversation about his mechanics are a little wonky. He needs some refinement. With Daniels, it's like, no. Whatever, you can debate whatever you want, but the throws look the same, the arm angles and all that every time. And, you know, obviously one way to get that done is repetition. And this is a really interesting way to do that. So I'll tweet out the links to these two stories from Alex, so you can take a look at them. But yeah, I think, you know, obviously here, especially now that it looks like we think that Jaden Daniels could be the pick, it's going to be an interesting angle to look at. And I'm curious to see if he does come here, wherever he goes. Is there, I don't know, it's probably not like you can't just click on your computer and do this thing, but I'm sure he would like to keep doing it.
Well, it's actually something I'm really curious about as well. Like, how will the team that he ends up landing, and say it's Washington, like, will they be able to integrate some of this stuff? Will they work with him? Will they be open to it? Will they believe it if he wants to do it? Will they build it out? I mean, what's hard to explain is in Germany, this company called Cognilize had this product, but they needed LSU to explain a lot of football to them. And essentially, they integrated their entire playbook and had to sign an NDA to be able to give it to Germany, to the people in Germany who built this out. Like, will the Commanders be willing to do that? Will they be invested? Do they have an R&D staff capable enough to build this out? Do they think it's worthwhile for his development? I would argue without question, 100%, especially if it's something he wants to do. And so we'll be really interested to see kind of if you hear about this, if he ends up landing in Washington and how that process maybe goes.
And to the point of the prior conversation, so much of this comes down to we focus so much on the coach and the GM and the owner willingness to both, you know, take that hit if you're going to accumulate the draft picks and willing to take some losses to then hopefully get better wins. But also these other investments, Josh Harris has so far shown a willingness to do it. They've had a real, even just this week, they've made a couple of executive hires. They were like, oh, okay, that's a notable one. They seemingly are putting in the investment, and you know, we'll see. I don't know where this one falls into play, but definitely something to consider. Alec, you I look forward to whatever big brain idea you come up with next to write about, and look forward to seeing what the Vikings do. Do you want to give me a final prediction here on what ends up happening? Do they stay at 11 and do something, or do you think they ultimately move up?
What I would say, and this is just my gut feel, is they're going to do everything they can to get to like a 3-4-5 type spot. And whether it's Drake May, JJ McCarthy, I mean, I think that would be the preferred option. Is it 100% guaranteed they're going to be able to get there? Can they, are teams like, I mean, my question is, are teams like the Giants, Broncos, Raiders potentially going to be overly irrational to get to that spot and maybe more irrational than Kwesi Adofo-Mensah would be? I think it's a valid question to ask. And if that ends up happening, then I would expect them to stay at 11, 23, maybe pick a really high level defender and then a Penix, Bo Nix. But I'd be very surprised if the first round ends Thursday night and they don't have a new quarterback, rookie quarterback on their roster. That's what I would say. That's my best guess.
You rock. I appreciate it. As I said, I'll tweet out those stories. I don't have it in front of me. Apologies. What's your Twitter handle? At Alec underscore
Lewis. The people want me to get rid of the underscore. I mean, I can't. I think there's another Alec Lewis. He's probably cooler. He's probably better. He's not as nerdy. I mean, this is how it goes. The underscore is what it is. But on a serious note, thank you, Ben. It's fun to talk. I appreciate kind of the interest. It's two really ridiculous stories that somehow I found, so it's been fun.
You're gonna have to do a story on the underscore. I think the underscores are terrible. You've built a brand. I'm not saying change it now, but in general, yeah, underscores are awful. I'd like to hear what the Nobel Prize winning economists think of the underscores. So that can be your project for the next time.
There you go. I'll tell my editor and he'll block my Slack, but
I appreciate it, man. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, as promised, joining me here to help us talk about the draft, one of the go-to guys this time of year, NFL Films. He's everywhere talking to everybody, Greg Cosell. First off, thanks for doing this. Second of all, have you figured out your vacation yet after the draft is over and you can go away somewhere and hide?
What's a vacation, Ben? I don't. Seems like I don't really do that, you know? there's still a little less than 2 weeks. There's more players I hope to get through in detail. So it just, you know, it takes time. I mean, because I'm not just doing quarterbacks, you know, I'm doing every position. So, and certain positions take more time than others, particularly defensive players on the back end, safeties and corners. You have to watch a lot of tape.
You know, obviously, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this. There are people who do what you do. This is what you do. But then there are the amateur people who look at tape and you know, people, because there's a lot more access, right? I can go on YouTube right now, type in somebody's name, and I'll see cut-ups of every pass or every play or what have you. That doesn't mean you know what you're looking at. It means you have access, but it doesn't mean you know what you're looking at. Like, what's the thing, like as somebody who's done this for a while, that you know is like, okay, I know what I'm doing because I've done this?
Well, I mean, I'll give you a very quick anecdote. We got the coaching tape at NFL Films in 1991 or 92, the NFL coaching tape. And I did not play football in high school because I grew up in Queens in New York, and my high school did not have a football team. So I played basketball and baseball. I'm sure I would have played football if my high school had a football team, but I didn't. So therefore, I was never coached in football. But I had been with NFL Films and for 12 years by 1991, and in fact, created the matchup show in the mid-80s. So, you know, in some ways, I'm the one who created X and O football on television. But the point being that when I got the coaching tape in 91, I had to learn the game through the coaching tape. And in all honesty, I would say it took me 4, 5, 6 years before I was even comfortable. And even then, to this day, and I've been watching coaching tape and I've been very fortunate, as you know, to know a lot of coaches, personnel people, you know, former coaches, former personnel people. You're always learning. If you think you know all the answers to these questions, even the things we're going to talk about, where people, I'm sure, want me to give a definitive, bold statement, you know, it just doesn't work like that. You're always learning. And there's just so many different variables, particularly when you're talking about college players being projected and transitioning to the National Football League. So, you know, if you think you know it all, then that's when you don't know it all, because you never know it all. So it's, you know, do I know a good amount? Of course I do. I've been doing it a long time and been very fortunate in my career. But there's no way I would sit here and tell you or anybody else that what I'm about to say to you is you can etch it in stone. I'm 100% right. And that's the way it is. You know, that's just not, if you're, I like to think I'm have some reasonable intelligence, Ben. And there's no way if you do that, you can look at it that way.
I'm with you. It's one of the weird things about how this all works, right? Is that in order to get people to believe in you, you have to project a level of confidence. If you're just like starting off, a level of confidence that says, hey, look at me, don't worry about anybody else. But to do it right, and I'm with you, I like to live in the gray as opposed to just saying this is, yeah, this is a black and white thing. That tends to lead to less overt, I mean, I'm sure you're confident what your views are, but less overt, sure, cockiness or confidence in that regard, because you're saying, well, there could be another option. I'm not just telling you it's only one way. And that's
and that's where the variables part come in. And I know we're going to talk about quarterbacks because obviously the Commanders are drafting number two, and they're going to take a quarterback. It's just a matter of which one they choose. You know, I'm sure there's been a lot of reports here and there, but you don't know until they turn the card in. So there's so many different variables as to what happens with quarterbacks that do have traits, that do have some flaws. They all do. No one comes into the NFL as a finished product. No one is transcendent, despite what people might say about Caleb Williams. No one is transcendent when they're starting, first coming into the league. So you have to look at traits, attributes, then all the other factors that we don't know about right now, because they become a function of where they go. And we don't know the answer to that right now, as you and I are speaking on April 12th.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, Adam Peters, one of his early comments once he got on board here, said of the draft, basically, this is all about judging other human beings. That's not an easy thing
not
to
at all.
Do. And, you know, I think that's the most important thing I would tell people to take away from all this, that no matter, we're all trying to figure this out, but whatever is going to happen, I you know.
I will say this, though. No matter what statistics and metrics and analytics are out there, you have got to watch a guy play football. It comes down to watching a player play football. You can look at all the analytics you want. You can look at all the metrics. We know that that's become, you know, more important. And I'm not saying it has no value. Believe me. You know, I've learned over the years. I've had to grow with that just as everybody else has. So it's not that it doesn't have value. But if you're using that, to me, this is a personal opinion, some might disagree, as the foundation of how you evaluate and project a player, I think you have to watch him play football.
Makes perfect sense. All right, let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you a question I was going to ask you later, but I'll ask you at the top now of watching football. I remember when Jack Del Rio came on board with the command, or whatever they were called at the time, one of the other names. When he came to Washington in 2020, I asked him very early on, when you just were watching tape of your guys that you're going to now coach, whose tape does, when you're sitting there and you can't turn it off, and you just want to watch somebody play football, whose tape do you enjoy watching the most? Is there anybody here, you know, you clearly not a guy who is, you know, turning off your mind at the end of the day, but you're like, you know what, this, I just like watching this player's tape. I don't care what position they are in this class. Anybody like that for you come to mind?
Oh, you mean regardless of quarterbacks, or
it can be quarterbacks, sure. But anything.
You, God, I've seen so many guys, and I'm trying to think of guys when I watched them that I went, God, I really enjoyed that. Let me think. I'm trying to think of the listed. I would say Byron Murphy, the defensive tackle from Texas, was a really enjoyable watch for me. You know, just the way in which he played. I really liked watching Ladd McConkey's tape a lot. Just loved the way he ran routes and understood how to do that. Because receivers, you know, when you run routes, particularly when there's an off coverage corner, you have to get him off his spot or get his body turned one way or the other. And you do that using your vertical stem with head feints, your feet. He was just really, really good at that in this draft class. I know I'm missing a lot of guys right now.
No, it's all good. I mean, those are good. I mean, McConkey, I'm sure people know, but the slot, you know, kind of a slot receiver out of Georgia, he could be there for Washington. Top of the second round if they want a slot receiver. Murphy, I would think, is gone by the time we get to the Bengals at 18 or the Rams at 19, not to mention defensive tackle may not be a position. This may be the one position this team doesn't want.
I mean, it all depends. Obviously, they're in a, you know, they're going to – every team drafts these days the best guy for their needs, unless it's someone that just truly fell that they said, oh, my God, he was the seventh player on our board, and we're picking 21st. We got to take him, you know. But for the most part, teams pick the best player at a position of need because they have to line up a player at that position. You know, that's the way it works.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's get to the quarterbacks. And I'm trying to think of a way to ask you something that you haven't been asked before this cycle, which is probably impossible because I know so many ask me about these quarterbacks. Just throughout the cycle, pick any of these guys. What did you think was the most interesting thing you discovered, whether it was watching tape or I don't know to what degree you worry about talking to people, but just as you're watching these guys, what was the most surprising thing that you were like, oh, okay, I didn't know this player had this trait, or ooh, kind of thought there'd be more here?
I don't know if I found anything that was totally surprising because, you know, obviously, while I don't sit at home on Saturdays and take notes watching college football, and I also don't sit and watch college football from 12 noon till midnight on Saturdays because, you know, I usually work a decent amount of the day on Saturdays during the NFL season. And then when I do get home, I'll put on college football. But it's just like, you know, it's rolling over me. I'm not, you know, studying it.
Yeah.
But I'm familiar with all these guys. So I wouldn't say anything was truly surprising or I went, oh, my God. But, you know, I just like really getting into the weeds and the detail of it. That's what I really enjoy. I'm a process guy, Ben. As you probably know, we've talked before. I love the process. And that's kind of the way I approach it. I love to dig deep and then try to figure out in my own mind how I see a player transitioning to the league. But that to me is the fun of it. It's in many ways, once I started the coaching tape and really got into it years, you know, over 30 years ago, for me, it's kind of an academic and intellectual process.
That's why I like talking to you, because I view the same way, but with less IQ.
I appreciate that.
All right. So let's just get in one of these guys. Let's just get into Drake May. Cause like from you said, you know, these guys, and obviously he, other than Caleb Williams, was the most known of these quarterbacks, at least in terms of the perceived top four guys going into the year. And he was, you know, start of the college year. Some people were saying, hey, it may be him going number one, and don't assume it's Caleb Williams. But whatever the reason, the new offensive coordinator lost some pieces around him, or just, you know, he's a human, things change. The perception is at least that he didn't have as good as of a year as he did. As you dug into the tape, what say you about, you know, just what this guy is presenting right now? And is it sort of an arrow north or an arrow going sideways or down?
I guess I don't look at it quite that way. I can tell you what the tape told me, and then you take it from there. You know, I think that you're dealing with a quarterback that has high level traits. He's 6'4", 225, which, by the way, is a trait. Size is a trait. So he has size. He's got arm strength. I think one area that is probably a little too erratic and is somewhat concerning as you transition him is his ball placement can tend to be a little erratic. And I'm talking about on routine throws, which you know, that, as I said, that can be concerning. You have to decide when you evaluate him where you fall on that spectrum. Because the way it works, Ben, if you spoke to, and I know you've spoken to a lot of people, if you've spoken to 15 quarterback coaches in the league, they would probably have the same 15 traits that they would say, here's what I'm looking at and for. The question becomes the value they ascribe to each trait. Yes. Different coaches might ascribe a different value to a particular trait. So ball placement is one of those that's non-negotiable. There's no coach that would say, hey, it's okay to miss routine throws. No coach would say that. So when you look at May, that would be one thing that is a little concerning. The other thing that I thought was a little concerning, but this is fixable, is, and I noticed this even in his 2022 tape, because I watched him last summer from 2022, is he had a tendency to what we call drift in the pocket. In other words, when you have a straight drop back, whether it's from under center or shotgun, you have to drop straight back because that's how your offensive line is pass protecting. They're expecting you to be in the pocket based on the play call. He had a tendency to drift to his left. So what that does is it creates your own pressure because you're moving toward offensive linemen who are protecting based on you being 3 feet or 5 feet further away. So he would drift to his left, which he still did this year. That can be corrected. But again, if he's been doing it his whole life, it's always easy to say something can be corrected and doesn't always get corrected. But then if you look at the overall player, he's a poised player. He's a composed player. We saw him with the offense that he ran, that he worked through progressions. I felt watching him, he trusted the route concepts. He trusted the route combinations. There were times, because he does have a very good arm and is such an easy thrower, that I thought that his timing wasn't exactly what it needed to be, that he could be a beat late. There were also times where I thought that he didn't process the route concept versus the coverage as quickly as he needed to. You know, and again, now you get into coaching, where he goes. Can these things be fixed within the context of who's coaching him and the offense and the pass game he's being asked to run? There's no question, though, when you finish watching Drake May, you come to the realization that he clearly possesses the necessary physical traits. He's a good athlete. And, you know, you think that this guy would have a chance to be a quality NFL quarterback. Again, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, he's going to be a top three quarterback in the league, or, oh no, he can't make it. You know, there's too many variables. So that's why when I present this, I'm presenting it as, hey, here's the good things. Here's the things you see, you know, take it from there. You know, he look, remember when Josh Allen came out and Josh Allen was all over the place with his ball location in Wyoming. And you could give 20 reasons for that if you want to. But the point is that's improved dramatically in the NFL. So you don't know the answer to that question, but that's what Drake May is when you watch his tape.
You know, the point you made a few moments ago about everybody will be essentially looking at the same 15 things, but it's how you assign them the value of them.
Right.
This is exactly the question I've been asking. I had Chris Sims on, I had Dane on, and asked them sort of that, tell me what matters the most to you and how you're looking at this, because ultimately that is kind of that's why some people say Drake May is great and other people say ugh,
because I mean, look, the ball placement is an issue. If that doesn't get cleaned up to some degree, and I think he's capable of it because he's also made great throws that really required precise ball location. So it's not as if he can't do it, but that would absolutely need to be cleaned up to some degree. Now, if you feel that can't be cleaned up, you may not like Drake May. You might think he's not going to be a really good quarterback in the league or even a quality quarterback. You may think that. If you feel that's something I can get cleaned up a bit with, you know, maybe some technique work, fundamental work, whatever it may be, then there's a lot there about Drake May that you could feel good about. But, you know, that's the way it works. And, you know, different people ascribe different values. I mean, in all honesty, like I said, if he's going to miss routine throws, that's going to be a problem, Ben. No question. You can't do that in the NFL and be a high-level player. But if it can be cleaned up, he could certainly be a high-level player.
The you mentioned coaching as well. Obviously, that's a huge component. And you're, if you're a smart team, you're trying to match up the player to a system and as best you can. But, of course, you know, Washington had to go out and hire an offensive coordinator a couple months ago. They landed on Cliff Kingsbury. And one connection, a loose one to a degree, is that Kingsbury's came out of college, out of that Mike Leach system, the air raid offense. And Drake May played in an air raid offense, at least under Phil Longo, who was the OC before this year. And I've had Longo on here as well. And he and Kingsbury are friends and all that kind of stuff. You because you're one reason you're fun with this is because you also cover the NFL. You're not just a draft guy. So you've seen a Cliff Kingsbury offense in the league. Based on what you've seen, do you think Drake May fit makes sense because there's some familiarity, or is there another one of these guys that is a better, better fit?
Look, Drake May obviously played for Phil Longo 2 years ago. He's very familiar with probably the methodology of the offense, probably the verbiage, probably the way the plays are called. You know, all these things matter. Think about this. Think about how many quarterbacks in college football never huddle. You know, people probably don't even think about something like that.
Right.
Now you have to go into a huddle and you've got to call a play, okay? And you have to call a play with conviction because the 30-year-old offensive lineman couldn't care less who you are. You know, he just wants to win games and get to a Super Bowl. He couldn't care less who you are. He wants you to be great, but he doesn't care. So you have to call plays with conviction. And then because you've never really done this, you know, a lot in your life, you've got to get up to the line of scrimmage as this clock's running down. And all of a sudden you look at the clock and you go, oh my God, there's only 9 seconds left before I have to snap the ball. And now I've got to look at the defense. And now I've got to do these other things. You know, these are all new things, you know? And like I said, I'm not sure people think about this, but this is the way it works. You know, there's so many different things that have to be taught beyond just, oh, well, he misses some throws, you know, which obviously you don't want to miss throws, but there's so many other factors that go into playing quarterback in the league. Just think about the fact that, hey, let's say he's a week one starter. Let's say Washington drafts him, you know, just, we don't know. And I don't want people to think I have any inside information because I don't. I'm just saying, let's say Washington drafts him because that's where you work and we're talking about the Commanders.
Yeah.
But let's say he's the week one starter. Okay. Let's just say that. Let's say on the second play of the game, he gets sacked. So now he's got to get up and he's got to get in the huddle. Well, you know, he's got to hear the play call in his head. He's got to call the play and he's going to get to the line of scrimmage. He's got to do all this in 35 seconds. Okay. And then he's got to have some sense of what he's looking at. It's not just calling the play, which may be tough enough as it is, because now he's doing in his first real game, which is different than calling it in OTAs or minicamp or training camp or preseason games. You know, this stuff's not easy to do. So we'll see how it all plays out, but you're dealing with a quarterback that has a lot of really positive traits and some things that absolutely need to be cleaned up. And if they're not cleaned up, you know, we'll see. It may not work. But he's going to be familiar. If Washington drafts him, he'll be familiar with the offense.
Right. And that seems to be beyond his own skill set. That seems to be the biggest plus in his column, as far as I can tell from, you know, sitting over here. They all have different pluses. And in the case of, say, J.J. McCarthy, I've heard some people say, I don't know what you think, but that if you were looking at a Kyle Shanahan scenario where you had a Shanahan tree coach and you said, get me that kind of quarterback, that J.J. McCarthy may be that guy in this class. And of course, Adam Peters was just with Kyle Shanahan since 2017 until taking this job. Dan Quinn had Shanahan as his OC for the Atlanta Falcons when they went to the Super Bowl. So part of me is like, all right, well, maybe there's something there, though Kingsbury is not part of that Shanahan tree. That said, so McCarthy, what's been your view of him? And you know, I guess to that point, is he, you know, could you see where like Dan Quinn and Adam Peters might be like, ooh, I bet Kyle likes this guy?
I would say McCarthy for me was a back and forth watch. I did him last summer too, from 2022. And of course I did him in great detail this year, you know, off his 2023. The first thing you have to do is you got to get rid of the fact that he won a national championship. That's not relevant to this conversation.
Right.
People might remember that in 2015, Jay Coker won a national championship going, I believe, 14-1 for Alabama. And nobody talked about him as a first round pick. So that's not really relevant to the evaluation. And it's always easy to get lost in he's a winner, which is one of those kind of semi-meaningless statements. And also the idea that, you know, he's a great kid, which is, you know, it's good. You want a great kid. May's a great kid, too. I would say that McCarthy, I kept going back and forth on because I don't think his tape was overall really that good. He missed a lot of throws. And he also made some throws that you wouldn't be able to do that in the league. In other words, he played behind arguably the best offensive line in college football. So he would throw 18-yard digs right in front of him to a wide-open receiver, which is ultimately not a hard throw, okay? And he would hitch up three times. And, you know, there's no route concept where you hitch up three times. So he did that a lot. But he also showed great willingness to make tough third down throws versus man coverage. That's a real positive in his game. In the NFL, you have got to make tough third down throws versus man coverage. He's got enough arm strength. The tape, again, we're not talking about him in shorts and a t-shirt at a pro day or at the combine. On tape, he did not have a big arm. Not that you need a big arm. And he worked kind of hard to throw the ball. That kind of bothered me. You know, I've had conversations with a lot of people I respect, and they always tell me that if you see a quarterback working hard to throw the ball, that, you know, you just want to be a little leery of that. So let's now talk a little more about him. I would say that he did show pocket movement. He did show the ability to slide, to climb, to move within the pocket. That's a really important trait. He would find space to deliver the ball. He needed basically to be on balance to throw the ball with a firm base. Ultimately, that's good, but you can't always do that in the NFL. I thought that his movement to throw was really good. I thought that he was athletic. I thought he could throw well on the run. Those are all really positive traits. But I just thought he missed too many routine throws. I didn't think he was a dynamic thrower of the football. And it was hard to judge him. He was in so many clean pockets.
Right.
And obviously, people can – here's a great example of you can take this however you want to take it if you're a coach. He did not have a game really on his shoulders. You know, maybe the Alabama game and, in the national semifinal game. Maybe, but he never really had a game where he had to put the team on his back and make those throws. You know, I mean, think of the NFL. Now there's 8 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. His team's down 27-17. You pretty much have to throw it on every play, right?
Yes.
Okay, the defense knows that. So the defense has a lot of the tactical advantage now because, you know, they know you're going to throw it. They're in their nickel, their dime. They have all their pressure concepts that come from that. You know, now you've got to handle all that. I'm not saying he can't handle it. Do we know the answer to that question? Isn't that a projection, Ben? Isn't that a projection based on his college tape?
Yeah, no, ultimately you have to, you know, if we're judging off of what they've done, you have to look at what they've done. And if he hasn't done these things, like you said, have the game on his shoulders down the stretch. For me, that earlier part about what's the skill or trait you care about the most, it may be for me because I've asked it a lot. It's 3rd and 7. It's the fourth quarter. It's not week 5. It's like the playoffs. It's like right. A big game. What happens then? And some guys, even the people we call Pro Bowl quarterbacks, that's not their thing. And I want that guy. That's for me maybe the number one.
Look, at the end of the day, and there's always an exception, and there's always coaching that plays into it. No one would say that Brock Purdy is a top 5 arm talent in the National Football League, okay? But they will say that Kyle Shanahan's offense is high-level stuff and really difficult to defend for many different reasons. So Purdy functions really efficiently and effectively in that offense, okay? He's in some ways, he's an exception because he's not a high-level talent. But if you're drafting a guy high, so if a team drafts McCarthy in the top 4, 5, 2, if Washington takes him. Yes, you want to have a really well-schemed offense. Of course you do. Every team does. You know, no one just rolls the ball out and says, okay, let's go make a play right now. You know, that's all we're going to do today. We're going to roll the ball out and run around and make a play. But the point is if you draft a quarterback really high like that, you're doing that because you think he can get you to the promised land, and you're going to play in a lot of big games, a lot of important games, games that are going to the fourth quarter where you've got to be the guy that makes the throws or makes the plays. And I'm not saying he can't do it. That's my point. I'm not saying he can't, but you don't know that. That becomes a projection. So you have to decide how you feel about the kid.
All right, fair enough. Now, you in terms of, I think Jaden Daniels to me seems really fascinating from a tape watching perspective. Obviously, he did very well last year. There's a lot of good highlights, a lot of the stats, not just the basic stats, but like the advanced stats. There's a lot to like. He's also a guy that played with two wide receivers who are probably about to be picked in the first round, if not in the top 20. He played behind a really good offensive line as well. Some of the numbers show he didn't throw the ball over the middle a lot. I don't know for sure if that's because the receivers on the outside or that's what the staff wanted. So I'm not sure. I can easily see getting wowed by the tape, and yet there's these other variables in his case that you've got to consider. So what did you make of his tape?
First of all, the wide receiver thing is to me not a legitimate argument. So that's like saying Joe Burrow is not really any good. He's just fortunate enough to throw to good receivers.
Right.
That to me is a pointless argument, because in the NFL, you're going to, for the most part, throw to good receivers. You know, I mean, that's the way it works. I would say that Daniels is super intriguing to me. Number one, he's improved each and every year. You want to see that. And I would say that his pocket command has improved significantly with experience. He's reached a level of play based on tape to me where he has a desirable combination of pocket efficiency and playmaking explosiveness. He does not look to leave the pocket unless it's the last deal. He plays from the pocket. He's got really good mechanics, really good fundamentals. He's bouncy. He's got light feet. He does not have a sudden twitchy arm. He's not a big power arm guy. And you see that on certain throws. There were some clear examples on deeper throws where they lost energy on the back end. But overall, he can make the necessary throws within the structured context of the passing game. And he plays calmly with a lot of poise. There's an easy fluidity to everything he does. I think he's a really good prospect. I mean, I think he can be patient and efficient from the pocket, certainly at the first two levels of the defense. And he's got dynamic playmaking ability to play stress on the defense in those critical down and distance situations. I think, and again, we're talking about quarterbacks. Are they all going to come in week one and be great? Of course not, Ben, but people will expect that if they're top five picks. And by the way, they're not all going to be great. When has there ever been a draft where all the quarterbacks that were taken high were great? So we don't know the answer to which ones are not going to be, which one or ones, but you're not going to have six. If you're talking sort of the main six, they're not all going to be great.
I hear you. I think that Eli Manning, Phillip Rivers, Roethlisberger draft is definitely the exception to the rule as opposed to the norm of what goes on around here.
Let me ask you this. No knock on this player, by the way, because I think he's going to be, really a solid pro.
Sure.
He's now played 3 years in the league. Is Trevor Lawrence great?
I would not say so at this point, even though he's good, but he's not been a difference maker to that extent.
And of course, he was given the term generational, which is now being thrown around again this year, which is a word I would never use, as you know. But I think Trevor Lawrence is a good player with a chance to continue to get better. Maybe down the road, we'll talk about him as a top three quarterback in the league, but we're certainly not talking about him right now. But yet, you can line up and win with Trevor Lawrence. I mean, there's a lot of quarterbacks you can line up and win with. The question is, when people say, well, if you get caught up in, well, if you don't win the Super Bowl, you're not a great quarterback. I mean, that gets a little silly to my way of thinking.
If these guys don't get the generational quarterback, the ones maybe in play for Washington, they will definitely get the franchise quarterback. And that's a term that drives me insane, because there's maybe four or five of those guys, Mahomes, Burrow, Allen, and maybe a couple of just because you get picked.
And you hear a lot of talk now about Josh Allen. Well, he's not really that good because he can't get them over the hump. I mean, that kind of talk gets a little silly overall, not just about Josh Allen, but that kind of talk can get a little silly.
100%. You mind if I ask you about non-quarterbacks?
Joe, absolutely. Go ahead.
All right. I've asked people for this poll I just did, or just other things I do, and I always say, just give me who's a guy, who's somebody you just like, and whatever. One name that's come up.
You're gonna have to give me some names because I've seen so many guys. It's hard for me to pick a guy out of the air.
No, I will. I will. One guy that's come up, at least maybe when I've talked about edge rushers, is Austin Booker from Kansas. He is not a first round guy. He maybe not even be a second round guy, depending on what I've seen. But he's a name that has come up multiple times. The Commanders do need more talent at that position, and they've got obviously 5 day 2 picks, so they could get him somewhere if they were interested. What if you've studied him? What's your view of Austin Booker?
Now he's a perfect example of a projection. He's only played 500 snaps in his college career, so this guy's a total projection. So again, you're looking at traits now. So okay, so you're not looking at what he is now. You're looking at what you believe he can become if you draft him. So what are his traits? He's long. He's a plus athlete, not an elite athlete. He showed flashes of that throughout his tape, both as a run defender and as an edge pass rusher. You see that it's in his body. You see that he's capable of being a quality edge pass rusher, showing quickness, showing some hand usage, some snaps of speed to power. That leads you to believe that he can become a situational pass rusher, if not a full-time player at some point down the road. But his tape also showed some concerns, and therefore he'll be polarizing. And again, I don't want to say a later round because he's not going to go in the fifth round, but you know, he's, like I said, he's only played 500 snaps. He plays too upright. And I don't know if that's fixable. I'm not a coach, Ben, so I don't want to sit here and act like I know the answer to that, but he played too upright. So what does that do? It limits your ability to play with any bend or flexibility. And he had a tendency to be kind of slow and sluggish off the ball, which really prevented him from challenging offensive tackles on the high side, meaning their outside shoulder, which you want to be able to do. So ultimately that, and he's got to get stronger. I mean, he's very wiry. He's 240 pounds. So what is he? If you draft him, what is he? You got to think about this. You know, what is he in your defense? So Dan Quinn's going to run this defense. He basically plays a four-man front. Basically. Now, he does a lot of things, but foundationally, he plays a four-man front. So what is he going to play in a four-man front? Is he a linebacker? Is he a D-end? He's not a D-end, in my opinion, in a four-man front. So that's part of the projection. So, you know, you have to think about all these kinds of things if you're going to draft him. Because now it's now you get to scheme adaptability. Scouts think about traits and attributes, not that coaches don't. Obviously, they want players with good traits, but coaches now think about scheme adaptability. How does he fit in my system? If I draft him, where is he going to play?
Yeah, and with Dan Quinn's system, like you said, guys are getting moved around. That they signed Frankie Louvu.
I love Frankie Louvu, by the way.
Oh, well, I'll circle back to you for that one in August. Frankie
Louvu. Always have.
But he's a guy like, you know, depending on where you want to line him up, he could be viewed in different ways. And
yeah,
we're excited to see where Dan Quinn is. It sounds like he'll be the Micah Parsons role, but we'll see how that goes. All right, let me ask about the guys who are blocking those types of players. Washington needs a left tackle. They could arguably use a left guard as well. They've got those two early second round picks, a guy like Jordan Morgan from Arizona. And then the kid with Kingsley Sumantaya, if I said that right. There you go. You had to say that before, I'm sure. Those are two of the guys that are like sort of in that late first, early second. If they're going to get somebody, maybe they hope one of these guys is there. Some people, like I had Dane Brugler on before. He thinks he's a guard, not a tackle. So I'm just sort of curious.
Yeah, who's a guard?
Morgan's a guard?
Morgan's a guard. Morgan's arm length is... No one knows the answer to this question other than it's true, but arm length matters, and it's very rare that if your arms are sort of less than 33 and a half, 34, and there's always exceptions, that it's really hard to be a tackle in the NFL, and Morgan's arm length is 32 and 7/8. He's going to be a guard. You know, I do think that he does have some light feet. He's got some fluid athletic movement. You know, I think that so many of these offensive linemen in college don't really know how to use their hands, but that's all teachable. So I think ultimately he's going to be a guard. He did compete in battle as a run blocker. I thought there were run game snaps where he showed that he's strong enough, that he had heavy hands. I think he can be a guard, and that's what he's likely to be, just because the arm length is going to be an issue.
Okay. So for a guy like, say, Sumi and Taya, or like, I don't know if you're into Patrick Paul, if you've watched him or not, but that's, you know, two guys who are also being picked in that second round.
Yeah, I've seen both of those guys.
Okay. Either one of those guys you see as a left
tackle? Duamete is a tackle. I mean, he fits the tackle role. He's got really good length now. I mean, his arm length is over 34. I like Suamatea. I mean, you know, when I say that, again, he's not going to be a top 10 pick, but I think he's got really good length. I think he's got easy movement. I think he's got some foot quickness. I think he bends a bit. Now, there's always concerns. We know that. You know, he's another guy that tends to be late and wide with his hands. And what that does is it allows the pass rusher to make first contact. You don't want that to happen. Sometimes he oversets and then he gets beat across his face. You know, these are all things that you work on. But I think overall, he can be a left tackle in the NFL.
Okay. And Patrick Paul, is that guy of interest?
Patrick Paul, now there's a guy that has the length that you absolutely want. I mean, this guy, I mean, if I remember, yeah, his arm length, he's over 36 inches with his arm length. He's ridiculous. He's 6'7" and a half, 331. You're talking about outstanding overall length, exceptional arm length, as I just said. Good athlete, not great, good. Needs a lot of work on his fundamental technique and pass pro. I mean, he doesn't play with great balance, doesn't play with great leverage, plays with wide hands. He's a guy that needs coach. He may not be ready to play early on.
Okay. If I can squeeze in one more question, because sure. You've been very generous with your time.
No, go ahead. I love talking ball. You know that.
The tight ends. Okay, there's Brock Bowers. That's not in play for Washington unless massive things are – I don't know what's going to happen. There's seems to drop off. Depending on what, you know, whose rankings I look at, there's, you know, not like an obvious other guy to get picked in the first round, top 50, or who knows. And then even when you get into those picks, there's various people. There's the kid from Texas whose name I'm blanking on.
Octavian Sanders.
Him, and then there's the kid that was it Jared Wiley.
Yeah, I kind of like Jared Wiley. I did him. Octavian Sanders, to me, would probably be the next guy. Obviously, Bowers is one, and there's no real 1A. But here, let's mention Jared Wiley, because he's a name a lot of people might not know. He's out of TCU. 6'6 and an 8, 249, ran well at the combine. You know, all the athletic testing measurables, he did well. Long arms. I kind of liked him. He wasn't deployed much in the TCU offense as an intermediate and vertical receiver, but I think he's got the physical and athletic traits to do that. I think he can be a seam stretcher. I think he can be a viable intermediate receiver who can run multiple routes. You know, he worked a little bit as a blocker. I wouldn't say he's a really good blocker, but I think you can, as long as someone's willing, you can make them a good enough blocker as a tight end. I think he's one of the most intriguing tight end prospects in this class who's not being talked about. But yeah, I kind of watched his tape think, you know, because I watch these guys, Ben, as you know, with the thought of what can they do? What can they do in the league? How can they be deployed? You know, what's the best way to deploy them? That's what I think when I watch them.
Yeah, no. And I this is one thing that's always interesting about the draft. You know, there's this notion out there that people think there's misinformation being spread out, and certainly there is some. There's also sometimes you hear late in the draft, hey, by the way, keep an eye on this guy. And Jared Wiley is a name that's come up now multiple times for me this week, even before you just said.
Yeah, that I like him. So I imagine you've talked to people and they brought him up, right?
Yes, because I've been, you know, it's obviously it's quarterback, and then what else? And tight end. I think Washington needs one. They need something there, but. Yeah, like I said, there just hasn't been a lot of names that really stood out. But now Wiley's the name that's come up a couple times this week. And at a minimum, like, I think they need more size, whether it's a Keon Coleman type receiver or a pass catcher at tight end. Both are one. And that's where I'm trying to figure out, like, for Washington, which kind of guy would they go with, a size at receiver or a pass catcher at tight end?
Well, Wiley to me is a really interesting prospect. I mean, again, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh yeah, he's going to be, you know, you just don't know, but I think there's a lot to like on his tape.
Okay. Greg, you rock as always. You appreciate the time. Anything we need to know from your world? You were on talking and doing work all the time, but do you have any shows or
we're actually shooting our our one and only NFL matchup draft special, which will air next Thursday night, the 18th. I believe it's 7:30 on ESPN2. So, and then it'll have re-airs. But myself, Sal Palantonio, Darius Butler, and, you know, since we only do one show and it's only 21 minutes, you know, the reality is we're in a league. You know this. Look at the first 10 picks in the draft. It's very possible 7 or 8 of them will be quarterbacks and wide receivers.
Yeah.
But that's what we're going to focus on. You know, the league is about scoring explosive plays. We're going to focus on that just because we kind of, you know, that's kind of where we're going. And that's the way this draft is going, quite frankly.
Okay, we got to get you more airtime. What are they doing over there? Come on.
I just show up and, you know, hope that I can get into my computer, Ben, you know.
I hear you. Greg, greatly appreciate it for the insight. And obviously, you know, it's at Greg Cosell, I believe, on Twitter. Go check him out there, because it's not just he's kind enough to talk here, but he talks to a lot of others and often puts up the clips, and you want to hear more from Greg beyond this. Thank you so much, and we'll see what happens.
Man, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate it.
And I'm looking forward to the Frankie Luvu conversation in August.
Love Frankie Luvu.
Thanks. All right. I really enjoyed both these conversations. I enjoyed them all, but I these two really hit home for me on both the evaluation side of things as well as the theoretical side of things. I do find it fascinating how teams choose to ultimately make their choices. We can never forget that it is a business, that you gotta satisfy your paying customers. Can you do that in a way while still building for the long haul? It's a challenge. There's no argument about it, but you know, so far so good, I think, with the Commanders, and we'll see what happens here in the draft. That is it for now. Ben Standick signing off. Until next time. Reminder, Thursday at noon on the Athletic app, I will be there live chat with all of you. Looking forward to it. That's it for now. Until next time.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.